The first ever episode of Tech Talk Texas. Today I'm joined by Dario Tachara, of over two decades in the technology space. So thank you for being on the podcast.
Thanks for having me, man.
Perfect. Well, I guess we'll kick start. And you're not originally from Austin, grew up in New York. So I suppose we'll dive in to sort of growing up in what it was like in New York.
Well, New York is very different than Austin. I grew up kind of in both worlds. The Long Island, where it's a little bit more suburban, and then the city. And one of the things that I liked about New York is that it gave you kind of a opportunity to meet people from all different places in the world.
Awesome. And in terms of sort of growing up then, how long did you spend sort of in New York?
What do you mean?
How long did you live in New York for?
Well, my family's always been there. I moved away to boarding school when I was 12, but that was always a place I called home, so that was a place I would come back to for vacations. On the island, that's where we would, as kids, get to explore, you know, go on boats. You know, I actually, my family grew up on an island off the coast of Long Island called Duck Island. It's only six families, so we were basically left to ourselves. And so always on vacations, that's where we'd be.
Yeah, awesome. And growing up, then obviously being involved with technology now for a long time, was that something you knew early on in sort of childhood team? When did you start getting involved with sort of technology and knew that you wanted to pursue that as a career?
Well, I didn't know when I wanted to pursue it as a career. In fact, I wanted to stay as far away from it as possible because my dad was really the influence there. He's an inventor, entrepreneur, he's invented all kinds of things. Entrepreneur of the Year, New York Technology Hall of Fame.
Wow.
And so I spent a lot of time early on seeing how he worked with his colleagues, seeing how smart they were, and always being a bit intimidated.
Mm.
I think it was only after graduating Boston College that I was trying to figure out what I want to do with myself. Realized I picked up some pretty good skills, or at least moderately decent skills early on in writing software, and then decided, well, this pays the bills, might as well try it. And then one thing led to another, and here I am 20 years later and haven't left.
Yeah, awesome. And going back then to your college days and sort of landing your first role, what was sort of the first role within sort of technology, and how did you sort of get to grips, I suppose?
So first job was just paying the bills, building websites. After that, graduated Boston College and joined a robotics company that did PCB manufacturing, and realized that they had tens of thousands of parts that we were constantly misplacing, running out of, weren't able to, always kind of buying on an urgent basis. And that led me to just say, like, oh, why couldn't I write some software to manage this? Of course, there was probably dozens of pieces of ERP software out there, but I decided to write my own. And then through that experience of learning what it's like to write software from scratch, figure out how to adapt it to the environment, meeting the people in the stock room, talking to them about how they do their work, figuring out how technology could adapt to help them, just put the bug in me. I just loved that aspect of it. And one thing led to another, and I did more ERP, for bigger companies after that.
Yeah, okay, awesome. Am I right in saying you spent the large part of your career based in New York, and you've also lived in Edinburgh, is that right?
I've been around. So initially New York, then China, parts of Europe, and now Austin.
Okay, awesome. And touching on Austin, when did you move to Austin?
4 years ago, just about 4 years ago.
And what was sort of the driving point in decision to move down to Austin?
Like many people in tech, I was drawn by the job, but also because I'd lived through parts of the pandemic in New York City, I was ready to see some green grass.
Yeah. And moving on from that then, in terms of Austin, how have you sort of transitioned, settled into to life there? Because I know it's quite different to New York.
It's very different. So when I moved here, I hadn't owned a car since I was 20. And my wife had never owned a car and couldn't drive. So we both had to adapt to what it's like to live in a city, but one where having a car is, as you know, very necessary to getting around here.
Yeah. And on that then, in terms of the drivers in Austin, because for me, being from the UK, they can be a bit crazy. How do they compare to New York? Is it?
So you often will hear people complain about the traffic here. They have, it has nothing on New York.
Yeah.
Nothing on New York. The in New York, driving is a competition. You have strategies for how to move from lane to lane. Here, no. You can wait. You even stop for pedestrians. So, yeah. It's not bad. I think Austin's a great place to drive.
Yeah, I think Florida's where I've been through the worst place for drivers is. There's no, I don't think the indicators work on the cars out there. From that, in terms of sort of Austin and Texas itself, then, is there anything you miss about New York that you wish you could bring to Austin?
Oof. Well, when I first moved here, definitely some of the restaurants I missed. Some of the museums I did like, just being able to go out on a weekend and go to a great museum. There are some good places here in Austin. I've actually seen the food scene pick up a lot over the last few years as well. So, you know, it's also just an adjustment. Different sorts of things people like here, different ways to get to know people. So adapting to that has, you know, just have to jump in with both feet and see how it goes.
Yeah, I think the food scene is incredible here. I mean, I've tried so many different food trucks in different restaurants now. I'm ticking off barbecue food places and it's a real luxury.
Did you find your perfect barbecue place yet?
I'm still on the hunt. I think Franklin's was really good. And then KG Barbecue was also really good. Went to Lockhart Barbecue Festival, which was a taste of everything. It was, yeah, a lot of food was ate that day. I was going to say that in terms of sort of the food scene here, do you have a preferred spot you like to go? Anything that sort of springs to mind straight away?
For me, I'm really big into ethnic food, so there's a place called Mezami that I really appreciate. It's it kind of reminds me of a New York style Mediterranean place. So that's one place that I really appreciate.
Oh, nice. And what would you say your favorite part is about living in Texas?
I like the Keep Austin Weird vibe. Mm. I've always kind of gravitated to places that are eclectic, different, that make me think differently. I know that like proper Austinites will say, like people that grew up here will say, oh, the city's changed a lot. But it still has, at least from my outsider's point of view, a little bit of an edge that you don't see everywhere. For instance, one place when I was looking for houses, I went looking at all these different houses, and you go to one place and I walk through it, and there's a set of baby dolls all arranged to be kind of like staring at you when you walk in the house. And not to say like that's like a big plus, but that's just not unusual for Austin, that there's just this weirdness, this daring to be different that you know, might be a little off-putting in other places, but here it's just kind of like, oh, okay, that's normal.
Yeah, I remember when I first moved here, I was having a conversation, like, that's a bit odd, isn't it? People are like, we'll get used to it. and Uber driver's telling me, like, yeah, this is a bit different, this is a bit different. But it's definitely cool that the city definitely stands out. And I think for me as well, probably 90% of the people I've met here aren't from Austin.
That's right.
The unicorns, as they're called, that end up down here. And what would your advice be to anyone who's from New York, you know, looking at Texas, looking at the tech scene, thinking maybe I want to move there? What would your advice be to those sort of people?
Definitely don't just pick the first place. It's just like parts of Manhattan. You have to experience them in a little bit of detail before you really understand them. So don't just jump in and, you know, pick the first location that you find because it looks most convenient. You have to actually see what it's like. So there's a big difference between North and South Austin, and even different small districts within North and South. You'll see different type of food scene, different type of people hanging out, you know, how many kids there are versus, you know, singles and stuff like that. So definitely try different things, go to take an Airbnb in different areas and get to see what it's like.
Yeah, for sure. I think it's different from us. I sort of just packed my bags and moved about ever visiting and haven't looked back, but in hindsight, I probably should have done a bit of research. Cool, we'll dive back into Texas a bit more detail later on, but diving into sort of your background, I know recently over the last couple of years been heavily involved with AI, so it'd be good to get your understanding of when you first got involved, sort of the AI side and how that sort of developed over the years.
Well, the way that I think about it is that there's several different generations of AI. So I got involved initially in applications that could use large data, big data, in order to make decisions. Now, most of these technologies were pretty directive. So you could say precisely how it's going to behave. Whereas now we're getting into AI that is more human in some respects. It can be more probabilistic, but less hard to predict exactly how it will behave, but more interesting for them.
Yeah. And with AI developing at such a rapid rate, it's scary, as you mentioned, sort of losing some of that human aspect. Do you think AI is taking away too much of the human aspect of life?
Well, I don't think it has really made the kind of impact that it will yet. We're still in the very, very early stage, but I think what we can expect is that over the next 36 months, it will change almost every aspect of human life in a noticeable way. And in some respects, it will be dramatic. Beyond that, it will also impact the way that we live and think in subtle ways as well. And I think that there's a responsibility for us to be intentional and thoughtful about exactly how that's going to work.
Yeah, awesome. And then in terms of keeping sort of trust in the AI technologies that are advancing and things are changing so drastically, what type of strategies can we sort of build and put in place to maintain our trust within AI?
Well, I guess you have to first step back and ask whose trust and what their goals are. So I think for the vast majority of people, we're not tuned in. You know, I don't think people are really considering the impact that algorithms already have on our lives. I mean, it doesn't take AI for a computer algorithm to affect how we think and how we act. Look at how the algorithms on social media is affecting the early stages of development for kids. Think of the impacts that that's having on suicide, difficulties with forming strong and long relationships. It's affecting how people relate to one another. It affects their goals. It affects their long-term potential for creating the kind of lives that we would want for our kids. I think that we're in a situation where we might be one of the first generations where our kids have worse outcomes than we have had. And that's one of the things that, you know, I think about ethics, is that we should be considering the impacts of the decisions we're making holistically. And I don't think that we're really being intentional about it. So to go back to your questions of how do we build and maintain trust, I think a lot of the impacts of these sorts of technologies might be difficult to observe and also subversive in a way in which we will go along with it, but it will have negative impacts that we're not even considering. So trust is a hard thing. It almost sounds active, proactive, whereas actually what I think is happening is that a lot of the impacts are going and happening a little bit under the radar.
Yeah, and I think it's an interesting topic when you look at algorithms, for example, like you mentioned, social media. I mean, I'm moving apartment at the moment, and I looked at a sofa the other day, and now all I see on my adverts is just buy this, which is crazy. But you can put on the not so good topics, then all of a sudden that's all you're going to see, and dictate what people are viewing rather than, you know, looking at what their friends are doing. So it's definitely an interesting way of seeing how things can shape up from that side. And in terms of that, then, what steps do you think are necessary to sort of uphold sort of ethical standards and sort of best practice?
I think intentionality goes to a large part of it. One of the frames that I find is useful is to think in terms of return on investment. So like, think like an investor. I only have so much energy, time, resources to invest in the things in my life. What is the outcome that I want to optimize for from those investments? And for most people, when we talk in terms of return on investment, we're always thinking in terms of profit, money.
Yeah.
But the impacts can be quite more wide-ranging. Kind of go back a step, talking about the impacts of these things. There's this famous design of a prison, 1975. The architect was challenged to say, how could he create the perfect prison that the inmates didn't fight, they didn't try to escape. What he did is he created a circular prison. And in the middle, a watchtower. And in the watchtower, you could have one single guard. But the prisoners would never know if the guard was looking at them or not. So what would they do? They would self-regulate. So if you think about that imposed on modern technology can look at all of us, can understand exactly what we're doing, and it can help personalize a response to whatever we do. So if you're one of the people that are responsible for designing this sort of software, we should think about that response that it evokes. We should think about it in terms of the total impact that it has, not just the direct impact to the bottom line, but also think about how will it have externalities, things that are less direct, things that are not necessarily immediate, things that don't necessarily show up on the balance sheet. I think that there is a responsibility that people need to have to think that way. And even if you're not necessarily designing that sort of software, every single person that's working in a company today will have a role in deciding what that future looks like by the companies you decide to work for, or the influence that you could have over that software that gets adopted or built or that you use yourself. So everybody can have a choice to make in terms of their time, their energy, and their resources in terms of what outcome they can search for.
Yeah, and you mentioned sort of choosing which companies you work for, and I think I read the other day Mark Zuckerberg said about how he thinks AI is going to replace mid-level engineers in years to come, and I was reading that thinking, you're an owner of this huge business, are people really going to go want to work for you now if you think it could be replaced?
And not just years to come, he's saying this year.
Yeah.
And so is Sam Altman saying software engineering looks different this year, at the end of this year, than it did at the beginning of this year. One of the differences, so this is a technology, I think everybody agrees, that has the same sort of transformative impact potential as electricity, or steam engines, or the internet. I mean, that's pretty big impact. If you think about everything that we're affected by when it comes to just the internet or electricity, those are foundational. But more than that, the time scales. If you think about the time it took to get electricity to be leveraged in general, generations of people, they were still building factories in the shape that was necessary for steam power decades after electricity came online, partly because people took time for them to learn and understand this stuff. AI is so intuitive, the technology is so powerful, and the speed at which it can get deployed is so short that it will make all of our heads spin. And so that's why one of the things I think about is the next 36 months. It's not next decade. It's happening now.
Yeah, and are you seeing sort of in Texas as well, growing a hub, and obviously Elon Musk moving down here, how do you sort of see the landscape in Texas shaping up over those next 36 months?
Well, certainly there's going to be a lot of investment, and there's still people moving in. Texas is a place where there is significant presence of large companies, so you can see firsthand the things that people are working on, and you can share stories, and hopefully you can also share your code of ethics, what you want to bring to the table, and how you want those technologies leveraged for good.
Yeah, and how have you seen sort of the development in the tech scene since you've moved down there? Obviously, I don't think you've said movement it's COVID, so how have you seen sort of the uptake since?
Yeah, I mean, people are starting to be much more active in person. I think there's definitely a hangover from the pandemic where sort of the collaborative scene was not necessarily gelled back to what at least people talked about what it was before. But South by Southwest is always a time where people come in. There's a lot of energy into the scene. There's great meetups that are very active. There's also like one of the aspects of keeping Austin weird again. You can find your tribe. So
yeah.
There's different types of groups depending upon what you like. And so trying lots of different meetups, meeting people, having dinners, whether or not you want to go to places where there's talks and presentations, or whether or not you want to sit down and kind of have like a more casual chat. There's pretty much everything you want here in Austin.
Yeah, and I think it was interesting to see a lot more VC activity in Austin, a lot more entrepreneurs want to be here. It gets me thinking, is that keep it weird side of Austin, kind of more creative entrepreneurs that want to be down here? So I'm not saying they're rivals of Silicon Valley or anything, but what are your thoughts on sort of the rise of startups here in Austin specifically?
People do follow the money, and people do like to follow other startups where they can share ideas and find customers and so forth. So Austin is a good place for that. I also feel like the city's pretty young. The difference between like New York definitely feels more mature. The people that you meet networking are usually a little bit older. Here, there's a big UT presence. A lot of graduates stay in Austin. And then people moving in from California and New York as well. And so it gives it that kind of young, hip vibe. People are willing to experiment. Also a pretty informal as well, which I like.
Yeah. And on UT, have you checked out the college football at all since being here?
No, college football's not my thing. So that's kind of probably something I shouldn't say in Texas. But
yeah, I think that's the big thing I moved down here. It's like, you have to go to college football. That's the main thing people were definitely suggesting. And diving back to AI then, I think what's interesting, it seems to be so prominent in so many different industries now. I know in recruitment space, but classic emails, LinkedIn posts, reach out, and software engineers are using, but probably more a taboo subject where people don't want to admit that they're using AI at work. How do you feel about that?
Personally, I think that there should be a disclaimer when people are using it to massage their communications. So there's two things that I've noticed pick up quite a bit. Those cold email or messages on LinkedIn or whatever it is that just hammer you 10 times, and it's clearly not a human being that's writing these things. And I feel as if that's a little bit, it makes it harder to connect with people when you can't trust that they're who they say they are. And also there's another thing that's come out recently that I find fascinating and definitely the future, but also kind of scary, which is the ability to basically deepfake yourself.
Yeah.
So you can get on a video conference call and it'll look like you talking, and it'll look like you're very professional, wearing a nice suit, but you're maybe on a beach somewhere, just kind of half showing your camera.
Yeah.
To me, I find this sort of stuff, the lack of authenticity, to be something that I mourn a little bit.
Yeah, I think it's advancing at such a rate that all these exciting things are going back to just 5 years ago, or probably a bit more than that, Snapchat. Well, Snapchat filters, everyone thought it was hilarious, but now you're getting to the deepfake side where potentially dangerous, scam artists are going to evolve in all of a sudden there's a real risk of people's security, not just their appearance, but their details that could potentially be breached. It's interesting to see what's going to happen to up the security to prevent this.
Yeah, there's something called the Internet of Careers. I don't know if you've heard of it. It's
no.
The idea that you can blockchain your career in such a way where it's verifiable. I fell into this because partly I did consulting for a while, and it was also often very frustrating that it would take me sometimes weeks, sometimes months to get into a new client because the background check would take a long time.
Mm.
Nowadays, when you have people showing up for interviews that are not who they say they are, or, you know, anyway, there's all kinds of scams. Everybody knows these things now. Having some way to verify who you are is a way in which you can preserve not just your own career and give people trust, but also I think we need to find ways to build trust into that talent economy, because if we don't, it quickly become more and more undermined. And say, like, there's lots of people that already say, why build a business with people when AI can easily do as much or better, and you have to deal with all the headaches and the lack of trust.
Mm.
So I think it's something important for us to be investing in, figuring out. So the Internet of Careers, there's actually a great group that I'll plug. It's called the Velocity Network Foundation.
Okay.
They've come up with a protocol to help with that. Building trust there.
Also, we'll leave the link in the description to check that out. And I know we touched a bit on sort of the trust in AI technologies. And going back to trust, we mentioned obviously the scams that people can put on. I've seen it firsthand in recruitment where it's a really good fake profile picture and they get onto a Zoom camera and it looks legit. And when they're answering questions, it's just, you can tell it's ChatGPT or anything. So I guess I pose a question, not just trust in AI, but with the development of AI, are we starting to lose trust in people because of how it's advancing?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, you could look at interviews of Google executives. Many executives have, you know, gone on the record and say, like, the biggest problem with building technology is not technology, it's people.
Mm.
and it's not wrong. Human beings are naturally idiosyncratic. Hard to predict. And we say that, and I said earlier, that AI is unpredictable, but it's still much more predictable, at least as in its current form, than a person.
Yeah.
And so people will, so I think that there is a statement to be made. So why have a person do something when technology is much more reliable, dependable, works 24/7, never gets sick,
mm.
and I can pay in peanuts?
Yeah. It's going to be interesting to see how it develops and the rate it's developing at then. Do you think it's advancing at a rate that we're struggling to keep up with? I know we touched on people probably not getting on board or not knowing where to start. Do you think it needs to, people need to either pick it up quicker themselves, or do you think it needs to slow down a bit so people can get up to speed? It seems it's gone to another level.
Yeah. Anybody that can keep up with the pace of AI is beyond me. One of the things that I did early on was try to read every paper in the AI category of ArcSim, so peer-reviewed papers. And it got to be so many of them that it went through the roof. I couldn't even take a subset of a subset. So, so absolutely, it's outpacing what a human mind can keep up with. What to do about that, I'm not exactly sure. I don't think that you could slow it down.
Mm.
I think that the profit motive for innovation here and the intuitiveness of the technology are such that the natural barriers that exist, bureaucracy, people friction, market friction, information friction, all that stuff are just like little anthills in the path of this train. And so, I don't think there's any way to slow it down. I think we need to develop a language for adapting to it. And that's where I talk about ethics, I talk about responsibility, I talk about understanding the mission, the value that you're trying to drive into this technology. I think that's the to evolve with it as opposed to try to dam it. I often will say it's like a lot easier to redirect a river than it is to dam a river. It's much greater force required to prevent something to move. So that's the best we could do.
Yeah, I think I went shopping the other day, doing my food shop, and there was no one on the tills, and it was just all self-service, and it seemed like that could become the new norm. But I think for some people, especially the older generation that are so used to doing things a certain way and aren't up to date with what's going on, it's a risk for them of losing their livelihood and practicality, because I know it's could be quite simple to everyday people to do self-service, but for older people that may not understand that, that's something that could be stripped back from everyday life. And as you mentioned, they can AI can work around the clock 24/7 and replace people. So is there sort of an industry or side you think can, is really at risk of people losing jobs or being replaced by AI?
Well, we're already, I believe, in the middle of a white-collar recession, meaning that knowledge will be the first domino to fall. That's the, I mean, it's the modality that these things operate in, is information. And so if you build your career on having specialized knowledge and you command a high value for that knowledge, then there is a profit incentive to disintermediate you. And I think that there's a lot of value that will come out of that. Like, for instance, I might have a difficulty finding the best cancer researcher to help me with a diagnosis, and now I have it in my pocket, right? I don't need to wait 3 months for an appointment. That will improve health outcomes.
Yeah.
And it will be cheaper and all this other stuff. There's lots of benefits to disintermediating specialized knowledge. But on the flip side, what does that do to the rest of society? Sometimes you could think about, like, people often say, we adapt, human beings adapt. Every time anybody's ever said, cry wolf, like something, a technology's coming that's going to wipe out people's jobs, they say, people always find new jobs. I just wonder if we're not intentional about it, is that always going to be true? Because any environmental system that's adaptive will adapt to changing weather conditions, to a particular predator leaving or a new predator coming, unless it happens very, very fast and with very high impact.
Yeah.
And then sometimes you can get ecological collapse. So that's the thing that we have to look for, is just make sure that we are being intentional, thoughtful, aware of these sorts of issues, and that we're building it into our calculus, each individually, and ideally at a governmental and organizational level, that we're trying to be thoughtful about the impacts we have.
Yeah, interesting. And final question for you, so quite a broad one. And maybe difficult to answer, but how far do you think AI can really go?
How far can AI go? I think the hardest problems it has are things like how to give a great haircut. So things
not
that
you have to worry about.
The modality, yeah, you don't want one of those custom robots doing your beard right now. Not yet. I think the modalities that it's going to have the hardest time with are physical. But we're seeing already, leaps and bounds that these that this software can make. It's being able to advance faster than anyone predicted. So for me, if my money was on something, I would just say, like, sky's the limit. I think that these tools are demonstrating an ability far beyond what anybody expected, and will probably continue to do so. So I would hedge that direction.
Perfect. Well, I really appreciate you diving into, I know we covered a lot of different topics there, but it's been really good to get your insight. And once again, thank you for being part of the podcast.